You're watching ABC.
The South African government decides that journalists can no longer film scenes of black protests.
Eastern summertime, 7:30. In tonight's early music, we're to hear the second of four programmes in which...
I always wanted to be Biggles when I was a kid. I thought, wouldn't it be great if you could be Biggles? And now I sort of have the money to be Biggles, and I'm being Biggles. Everyone thinks I'm a bit eccentric.
Welcome to The Greening Years. I'm Carolyn Craig. And that was the voice of millionaire electronics businessman Dick Smith, my first guest in a series of programmes in which I'll be probing the memories of six well-known Australians. What makes Dick Smith, political analyst Bobby Sykes, dancer Sir Robert Helpman, architect Penelope Seidler, world tennis champion turned businessman John Newcombe, and actress Ruth Cracknell tick? Did they discover early in life that they were different? Were they encouraged as children to develop their special talents, or did they have a battle for recognition? Join me over the next 6 weeks as these well-known Australians talk about their relationships with their parents, siblings, and friends, about their school days, and those early formative experiences which have made them who they are today. Dick Smith is a person who likes to set himself challenges. Having built a multi-million dollar electronics empire, he then decided to fulfill a childhood dream, to follow in the tracks of the early Australian aviators and fly solo around the world, only this time in a modern helicopter. He sees himself as an adventurer, but says he's by nature conservative and always, in time-honoured Boy Scout tradition, likes to be prepared. His third great love, other than electronics and flying, is the Australian bush. Where did he grow up as a child?
Well, I suppose I really grew up in two houses, one in Roseville near the station, where I was born and lived until the age of about five, and then I moved over to East Roseville, which is a northern suburb of Sydney, and lived there until I left home and got married. So I suppose two memories. When I was very young in Roseville, I lived opposite my maternal grandfather, Harold Casno, who was a famous Australian photographer. And I suppose the clearest thing I can remember is going over to his home, which was just opposite, and watching my mother retouching the photos. And I was always a very lively child, to put it lightly, and I used to wiggle around and everything. And so one day, to get rid of me, they took me downstairs and they let me have a look in Harold's room. Now, Harold's room always brings back memories to me, because it was this room which I put the key in and undid the door, and there was all this radio equipment, panels of dials and transformers and things like that. And to a young five-year-old, it was just so exciting. Of course, I found out later that my Uncle Harold had been a radio enthusiast until 1940, when he went to the war, and he was killed in the war. And here I was in 1950, approximately 5 years later, looking at this room exactly as it was. And it was a room of mystery for a five-year-old, but it always excited me, and maybe that's what got me into radio and into electronics. Then I suppose the second part of my life was when I was over at East Roseville, living in the home, and I used to be allowed to go out in the bush by myself. I was very much a loner. And what I remember there most was going away by myself out into the bush and catching blue-tongued lizards and bearded dragons, and generally being able to be by myself without any hassles from anyone.
Do you think going out into the bush was something which you realised was something you wanted to do by instinct, or was that something that your parents encouraged you to do, or was it the inspiration of your grandfather's photographs?
I don't know. It would be interesting to really know. I just loved it, and I still do. I live here at Keringai Chase, right on my house actually sticks out into the beautiful bushland, and I love getting down there and, I shouldn't say this, but I like hugging scribbly gums, and very, very nice, very emotive. But possibly, I've always thought, gee, I'm not artistic like my grandfather or my mother, who paints as well. But I have a feeling that possibly I am, and I love getting out into nature. I've always enjoyed the out of doors, and I remember sort of my ambition was to become a National Parks Ranger until I found out that you had to have qualifications, a degree to become a ranger, and I had no qualifications, so it meant I couldn't become a ranger.
You said you were a bit of a loner. Were you aware of that at that age? Were you aware of wanting to be on your own and going and doing things without the company of other kids?
I don't think I really was. I think my problem was that I think I was different, and of course to be young and to be different, people sort of don't like you, especially your fellow friends, and if you could call them friends. And so it was really a problem, because I found that because I was no good at sport, not very good at school, and generally maybe I was forced to be on my own, but I tended to enjoy it. You know, I'd spend hours sitting under a tree looking at a bird or something like that. And I think I had a terrible inferiority complex, probably up until the age of about 21 or 22, whereas I always thought that I was inferior to most other people. Not that I really consciously worried about this, but I remember sort of shying away from anything that was a group activity because I knew I'd be hopeless and I thought people will probably laugh at me. One thing, and it's an important thing, is I couldn't say the letter S until I was about 8 years of age. And so that meant at school, I always used to say, if someone would force me to say my surname, I'd say Dick Miff or Dick Fish instead of Dick Smith. Or I remember it used to be Dickie Go to Cool, I always used to say. And this gave me a terrible problem because at one stage, one of the teachers didn't realise that I couldn't say yes and thought I was being smart and hauled me up in front of the class and then sent me down to the headmistress, who then rang my mother and found out that I couldn't say yes anyway. And of course, doing that to a young 6 or 7 year old, it really made me worse. And it's a wonder I can say yes now.
School wasn't a particularly happy experience for you.
No, it wasn't. I look back on it now and I think, why wasn't it? Because, you know, you sort of think about it as you're older, thinking that must have been a wonderful time. But generally, I hated school. In primary school, I actually only went to school, I think, 4 days a week on average. I always seemed to have a migraine headache, which I think was mainly made up. And I disliked it. First of all, I was pretty hopeless. And if you're not good at something, you don't like it. Secondly, I think that at the school I went to, Roseville Public School, mainly the kids were good at sport and everyone was supposed to be the same as kids seem to want to be. And I think I was always sort of the outcast, which I didn't like. And that sort of, I suppose, destroyed my confidence in school. And I repeated sixth class. I was so bad, everyone said I couldn't go to high school. And then finally I got to high school and I was just as bad for 3 years. And so I left at the age of 15. But I remember, even though I hated school, the job I got in a factory when I left school was so bad and so terrible and so boring, I eventually went back to school and I managed to get the leaving certificate. And in fact, in those last 2 years, I think I finally matured and I did quite a lot better.
What was the problem? Do you know what the sort of root cause of the problem was?
Yeah, I think the root cause was pretty simple. I just had no ability to learn in sort of an academic type way, and I still don't. If I understood something, I was great at woodwork and metalwork and tech drawing and things like that. But where you had to learn something, I mean, I don't like to admit it, but even now I don't know all of my 9 times table. And I just couldn't learn it. I've never been able to. When I recently went to get a pilot's license, you've got to learn that the phonetic alphabet, A is for, no, alpha is A and B is bravo. Well, I've only just learned it now, sort of thing. So I was utterly hopeless at that. And so that made me find very difficult to learn at school, to learn in parrot fashion sort of thing, to remember things. And so because I was no good at it, I generally disliked it. And I never really thought very deeply about it. I just thought, well, I'm hopeless. In fact, years later, my mother told me that they often used to talk about me, my mother and father, luckily not in front of me. And my mother used to say, you know, whatever will happen to Dick? Because I was so hopeless, and my sister, who was bright, and in those days, I think they would have far rather to be in reverse, you know, have the son being reasonably bright at school and the daughter doesn't have to be because, you know, she's going to get married, sort of thing.
Were they sympathetic to you?
Oh, terribly, yes. My father was strict, a disciplinarian, and my mother was extremely soft, so it was a great match. And I used to manipulate one against the other, of course. But where they were very good is they allowed me to be an individual. And they allowed me to go down to the bush. They allowed me to keep snakes and lizards, even when my little green tree snake got out one night at home. and crawled through the house and crept in underneath the bathroom. They didn't sort of mind that. I think they sort of thought, well, we've, you know, he's our son and he's a bit weird, but we've got to put up with it sort of thing.
They were happy with you being an eccentric.
Well, I think so. In fact, a couple of times I think maybe they thought I was a little bit mental, you know, and I used to sort of, I don't know what it was, but if a group of people would be there, I'd put on sort of a mad fit or something like that. And it wasn't so much to get attention as just to sort of say, look, go away, please. Even now, as I mentioned, I would far prefer to do that, whereas most people believe that you should actually draw, follow a straight line. One of the things which I'm quite often be interviewed about is people say to me, what am I trying to prove as a businessman, you know, that I am I trying to prove something different? And I say, no, I'm just myself. But because I'm sort of not sitting in a big office and going out for big business lunches and doing things like that, they think I'm the eccentric, whereas to me it just seems quite normal. And someone sort of said to me, look, you know, you've made all this money and now you're going out and doing these things. Why? Why aren't you sort of taking over bigger businesses and becoming a Rupert Murdoch? Mm-hmm. Well, my attitude is, I always wanted to be Biggles when I was a kid. I thought, wouldn't it be great if you could be Biggles? And now I sort of have the money to be Biggles, and I'm being Biggles. Everyone thinks I'm a bit eccentric.
Well, the way you talk now, it all sounds terribly highly motivated, which it is, given all the sorts of things you've done. But the way you're talking about your childhood actually suggests that you weren't particularly happy.
No, I don't think I was particularly happy, because if you're not successful at something that you want to be successful at, you can't be happy. And I think I wanted to be successful at school. I know I did. And so I wasn't happy there. I was only really happy when I went out by myself into the bush, or I joined sort of Cubs and Scouts, and I enjoyed Scouts. But even then, I look back and I was never a sixer in the Cubs, and I was never a patrol leader. I was never anything sort of thing. But I enjoyed that more than most things. And I suppose, I wasn't a happy person, because in those days, and maybe still now, that unless you sort of had some type of academic achievement or unless you were good at school, you were not successful. And I sort of had that idea. I think also having a sister who was a lot brighter than me, if you put it in the academic term sort of thing, and the fact that she was going to go to university and she did, that didn't make me very happy. Not that I begrudged her from doing it, but I just thought, well, I'm hopeless. I can't do that type of thing. And I tried incredibly hard, but I just didn't have that type of ability to learn in that way.
This desire to succeed, do you think that that came in some way from your parents, or was that very much something coming from within you?
I think it was an accident, actually. I never really had, people probably look at Dick Smith as the capitalist and sort of say, oh, you know, the capitalist, here he is, you know, ripping off all these people and so forth. And I look back and I can remember thinking when I was sort of an 18-year-old, if I'd met people like Dick Smith who had lots more money than most people, I would have thought, oh, what a terrible person. You know, how can he rationalise? How can he justify that? And here I was, I started a business with $600, and I never envisaged for a million years that it would be as successful as it was. I sort of thought, well, I remember I used to think if it had four or five people working for me, that would be the height of success. And when it ended up with 200 and 300 and 500 people and doing, you know, millions and millions of dollars turnover, I couldn't quite grasp what was going on. And so, because I was never really looking for that amount of success, I suppose I was more surprised than most people. And maybe I've never ever got used to it. I sort of thought, gee, you know, what happened? Was it my fault or luck, or was it skill, or was it astuteness? I don't know. Maybe it was a little bit of everything.
Were you well off as a family?
No, not particularly. We were, I suppose you could say, middle class. And also, when I was right at the age of about 15, my father, who was in the publishing game as a manager, he went out on his own in business. And it was right, I think it was 1960, in the credit squeeze, and his business collapsed. And he had what you could virtually say was a nervous breakdown. And here I was, my mother, who had never really gone out to work, had to go and get a job, and she did. And I remember I used to go up to Chatswood and look in the window to try and find the cheapest meat we could buy and so forth. And that gave me a tremendous shock to suddenly realise, I mean, there was no money coming in when my father was ill at first. And I think it made me a lot more understanding. And when I look back on my life, I've been so fortunate, because the things that have gone wrong have all taught me something, and meant instead of them going wrong later on where they can be very important. I've been able to sort of control them when they're happening and say, hey, that's what happened 20 years ago or 10 years ago. I'll make sure it doesn't happen again.
What did you learn at that age from that experience of your father having the breakdown and becoming ill and so on?
Well, I think I learned, first of all, I learned how important it was to have a good wife, a loving wife who was going to stand by you. And I made sure that when I eventually got married, it was going to be someone who I was quite convinced was going to be a loving type of person, more than sort of going out and looking for someone who was going to be, how can I put this, a number of my girlfriends at the time were doing university courses and so forth and probably had a far greater chance of earning more income than the girl I eventually fell in love with and married. But to me, I could see that it was more important to try and get someone like my mother, which I did. And the other thing it taught me was the great risk in going out in your own in business. And also, I suppose, one thing which I admired my father for, and that was that when the business was closed down, he owed a considerable amount of money. And I remember people saying, well, look, he doesn't have to pay that back. It's a proprietary company. But he worked and worked and worked, and he paid every cent back. And I remember asking him, you know, why are you doing this? Or asking my mother. And she said, well, it's his name. You know, these people put the money into the business, and he would never do anything unless they were paid back, which he did. And I think that taught me a great deal. And I think that's one other thing my parents taught me was, you know, to be honest. And I think that's a very important success for us.
You're with The Greening Years. I'm Carolyn Craig, and this week my guest is Dick Smith. Were there any unhappy moments for you, any really unhappy moments that you can remember?
Really unhappy moments?
I suppose I'm thinking of perhaps something cataclysmic that happened, like the death of a pet, or maybe even the death of a relative, something that influenced you at that level.
No, never, and never in my whole life so far. I'm 41 years of age. Something like that happened, which just means I'm just so lucky. I'm always prepared for it to happen. And I've never really had a really close relative die. I've just been so fortunate, I think. And I've been so fortunate in life, really, that nothing drastically has gone wrong except those bad school days, which I look back on now sort of, and I sort of think that maybe they're all okay. But when I look at my old school reports and things like that, I know they weren't. And now I've been very, very fortunate in that way. And I just don't know how long that will last, of course.
You mentioned Biggles was one of your early heroes, but also you have a great admiration for our early pioneer aviators. When did that begin?
I think I have an admiration for any of the early explorers and the aviators of any type, because to me, I suppose it was something you could sit down and you could read a book about, which I did as a kid and then I read later on. And they were heroes because they were out, they were pathfinders, they were finding something that no one else knew. And that was exciting to me. And I think that started at a very early age. And then with my scouting, I loved to go off and explore and to look for new things. And I used to imagine that I was Biggles or someone like that. And then when I learned to fly, I remember thinking, crikey, you know, this little plane is pretty hard and I'm only just flying it, you know, 50 miles or something. What would it have been like to be Bert Hinkler or Kingsford Smith, Charles Ulm, someone like that? It must have been incredible to do these long distances. And I read everything I could. I used to buy all the aviation books, and I think that's what sort of motivated me into doing the helicopter flight, because I thought, look, I've read so much about it, what would it be like in practice? Now, of course, going back to a young boy, I suppose most young kids read about Biggles, read about some of the early explorers, and I think I was probably a bit different in the way that I don't think I ever thought that I'd be able to do such adventurous things, but I always thought I would like to. Then when I was fortunate enough to make the money, instead of what most people seem to do, and that is they seem to throw that out of the window and then they say, oh, look, I've now got a responsibility to keep my wealth or to make more money or to do this or to do that. I couldn't get away quick enough, sell my business and say, hey, you know, I'm just so lucky to have a few bob to do these things. And as I mentioned before, you know, people got very suspicious and thought, what is this Dick Smith trying to prove to us, sort of thing? And I said, no, I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm just doing what most people would have dreamt of doing, and I'm going to do it. Now everyone thinks it's a bit weird that I am.
Apart from your parents and apart from your heroes, who would you say was the major influence on you in your childhood and adolescence?
Yes, in the younger days, I suppose, was a number of people. One, there was a chap called David McPhee, who used to be a keen sort of lizard and snake collector around in the next street, and I used to follow him around all the time. Then I suppose when I got into scouts, my various scout masters from time to time, who I sort of looked up to. And then I think when I left school, the greatest influence, I was very lucky, I met at the age of about 17, a doctor, a chap called Tony Balthazar, Dr. Tony Balthazar. And it was quite extraordinary because he was a bachelor who had his parents, I think he was tremendously under the thumb of his parents until the age of about, I think, 40 years of age. I met him through radio and electronics. He was a radio ham. Right when I think his parents had died, I introduced him to scouting, and I think he was so pleased that he'd learnt something new, that he'd been allowed to get out and love the out-of-doors. And he basically, I suppose, for the 3 or 4 years of those formative years from about 17 to 21, not only did we go on expeditions together, which he financed because he had the money to do it. At one stage, I went on a climbing expedition in Switzerland, which he wouldn't have had any chance of going on, so he came along too. And I suppose that influence was great. And then, fortunately enough, when I wanted to start my business, he said, oh, he'd loan me the money to start the business. And so without that luck of meeting him, I wouldn't have ever been able to borrow the money, because my parents didn't have any money, to start the business. So, you know, he was a reasonably influential person on me.
Dick, when for you do you think the greening years ended?
Well, in some ways I don't think they have, because, you know, I still hope that I've got that spirit of adventure that I had as a young kid, and in many ways I don't really think that it's changed at all. But I suppose the sort of the big change came from a fright that I had, and I must tell you the story. It'll take a few seconds, but when I was about 17 or 18 years of age, I had to lead a bushwalk, which was across one of the most rugged areas of the Blue Mountains. And I made every mistake that you could make. I don't know why. And I was very lucky because I got away with it. But myself and my two companions could have lost our lives. What we'd done, I was in charge of the bushwalk, and it was for one of the senior Rover Scout badges. And instead of being prepared, as you should always be, for very adverse weather conditions, I wasn't. It was fine weather, and in fact I knew that the particular walk would have been impossible if the weather was bad, if the visibility wasn't there. Well, we left on the walk, and after the first morning, the rains came in, and we had this most extraordinary rugged country to cross from a place near Nunes right across to the Putty Road, which is right across one of the most rugged areas of the Wallamai National Park now. And the weather came down, it got so bad. And the mistakes I'd made, first of all, the matches were not waterproof, so we ended up without any matches and no way of getting heat. Secondly, the map I carried was not in a waterproof container, so it gradually dissolved in the rain. And because the area was so remote and so rugged, without a map it was almost impossible to navigate, and we got misplaced. We had the Colo River to cross, and when we eventually got to it, the actual river was running a banker. We had to swim it, and didn't get drowned, but nearly so, and then climb an escarpment of about 3,000 feet, and we still knew that we had another, I think, approximately 10 or 12 kilometres to get into where the cars were waiting for us. A couple of vehicles had been driven out on a fire trail. Well, this got later and later at night. It was extremely cold. We were sopping wet. We'd had no sleep the night before, no food, and the only way we could get to the place where we were heading for was to walk up a stream bed, which I'd done previously in dry conditions, and it was a nice walk, but it was covered with the most incredible stream of water. At one stage I disappeared in front of the other walker, my friend, and all he found were my pack straps floating on the water, and he managed to pull them out. Do you know what? I had a torch. Luckily I'd taken a torch with me, and I had spare batteries, but it was one of these torches where if the batteries go flat, which they did, you unscrew a little screw at the side, but then all the parts fell out of the torch in the pitch darkness. So then we ended up with no light. And I remember thinking I had to try and keep the morale up of the two other people. And I thought, if we don't get in tonight, we're going to die, because it was raining, we were sopping wet, and we had no heat. Well, we walked and walked and walked, and it was on the Sunday night. We were supposed to finish on the Sunday at lunchtime. It got worse and worse and worse, and in the end, at about 9:30 at night, we just lay down right in this very thick scrub, and I thought, this is it. I remember I said to everyone, get in your sleeping bags, to the two other people, and we did, and the sleeping bags were just sopping wet right through. And we lay there, sort of huddled together, and I remember thinking, you know, why did I ever let myself in? Why did I make these mistakes? Why did I presume that the weather was going to be good? And we lay there, and as it was at 5 a.m. in the morning, we did awake, we were alive. Luckily, the temperature didn't drop too low. It was about March. If it had been June or July, we would have been dead. And we managed then to walk up. It only took us another 3 hours to where we got to the checkpoint where we were going to finish the walk. And, of course, all the search and rescue people were there because they knew that we would have been in serious problems. And I think that was sort of a turning point for me because I suppose it taught me just how fragile life is, how you can make one mistake, especially if you do things which are, I suppose, with a little bit of risk, you can die. And I think what worried me more about that was that one of the chaps I had with me was very inexperienced, and I knew that he probably would have been first to go, and it would have been my responsibility. And so that really rocked me, and I think at that age, very young, it really taught me something. And ever since, I never forget it sort of thing, and I've always thought, make sure you prepare, make sure you are conservative, you think of everything that could go wrong, because it probably will.
Do you have any religious beliefs at all?
No, I don't. When I was a young 5-year-old, I was very sceptical of everything. My parents tried to give me a religious education, sent me off to Sunday school and to confirmation classes, which I loved because the girls were real darlings there. But I've always been sceptical, and in fact, if anything turned me off organised religion, I was lucky enough when I was about 21 to do a trip around the world. And after seeing the most fantastic religions in the world, from the Muslims, the Buddhists, you know, and to go to Japan and see all the Shintos tying little bits of white paper to trees because of their religious belief, I realised, of course, that for me to pick any religion, in effect, I'd have to say all the others were wrong. And I just found I couldn't say that. And so, whereas I'm sceptical, I'm certainly not an atheist. I'm not even an agnostic. I'm sort of agnostic about agnosticism. My attitude is, well, look, you know, I don't really know which religion is right. I'm not running around searching. If it comes to me one day, well and good, and I become the strongest Roman Catholic or the strongest Muslim in the world, great. But in the meantime, you know, I'm going to try and do what I think is best for people and to give me the satisfaction, and a lot of that's helping other people, and that's the most important thing. And I suppose it's interesting because, you know, as a kid, a lot of people have asked me, they sort of say, why are you so sceptical? And I've said, well, look, as a young child, I never believed anything unless I could understand it. It's just in my makeup. And the minute I started with some religious training, I sort of looked at it and thought, that just seems crazy. And it wasn't as if my parents were sceptical. They were quite horrified when I would go home and say, I remember once I said, Mum, I said, the Sunday school teacher reckons that there's God and he sort of sits on everyone's shoulder and watches everyone. And I said, look, there's hundreds of people in the world, aren't there? I said, how could he be watching every one of hundreds of people? And she sort of said, oh, look, Dick, you've got to look into these things and wait until you get a bit older and, you know, and this type of thing. Well, the older I got, the less believing I became, of course, of the various, you know, different beliefs. And as I've mentioned, for me now to be able to say that this religion is the right one and everyone else is wrong, it's sort of, to me, it's sort of the height of conceit. You've got to say millions of people are wrong. They're all deluded. They're all wasting their time. And I can't believe that. I think the most likely thing is maybe everyone's right.
Would you say there was one single really happy moment that you can remember as a child?
Ah, lots of happy moments, but I'll tell you one of them. We used to, every now and then, Harold Casno, my maternal grandfather, the famous Australian photographer, used to come over to our place at Dudley Avenue, just opposite his house, and he'd say, would you like to go to the beach, young Dickie? And I'd get everything ready and I'd race over there.